The second notification in the society's paper that we received in the mail says 95% of testicular cancer patients now survive compared to just 73% in 1970. As we've noted before, testicular cancer tends to be one of the rare types as well, happening to the younger people, but it evades the 95% of cancers or so that occur. And then finally, the third one said 83% of childhood leukemia patients now survive compared to 17% in 1970. First of all, survival means 5 years. But secondly, again, that childhood leukemia is one of the 5% of cancers out there, ignoring the great mass of the 95% cancers that exist. And so we see that there's a little bit of, we used to say skullduggery in the way in which the stats are being used to present this society's little bulletin that says, great news, it's working, and asking you, of course, to donate to the cause. My point, of course, being that there is manipulation of the data that the general public is not aware of to indicate that there are better results than there actually are. And if you refer to what we have stated previously, you can find out that what we're saying here isn't a condemnation of the society, but it is a criticism of the way they're using the figures, because the figures do not indicate the truth concerning the overall picture with cancer. Right now, I am looking at a paper that has on the caption, quote, as I was using my Scientific American Medicine last night in reviewing a case, unquote. And what they have shown is a picture of a large cancer cell being attacked by a lone T cell. In this case, the lone T cell is acting like a pit bull and is attacking the cancer. What the cancer cell has done just before this picture was taken was extrude a lot of blebs. So hopefully that the T cell would just attack the blebs and leave the main part of the cancer alone. In real health, we should have more than one pit bull attacking a cancer cell. And I have a picture at the later part of one of my talks showing cancer cells surrounded by a large number of others and attacking the cancer cell until there's nothing left but a chicken network-like framework belonging to the cell, and with a couple of them staying in the middle sort of to clean up things, as it were. It's interesting to note that in order to break down cancer in tissue, one of the things that's necessary is that there needs to be a tear in the coat that covers a cancerous lump. The cancer has the ability of coating itself, and this was done by a Dr. Dvorkin in southern Dakota, where he pointed out that the majority of human cancers are coated with fibrin. And that fibrin happens to be us. So when the T cell comes along and it looks at the coat, it pokes at it and sniffs at it or whatever, and it says, no, that's us, and it moves away. One of the things we do, therefore, in the treatment of cancers is we give a combination of plant enzymes that has been found to put tears in the coat. Now, this was work done by Dr. Manner, the biology professor at Loyola University. And what these enzymes will do is put tear in the coat, so when the T cell comes along, it looks in the crack and says, oh my goodness, we've got a wolf in sheep's clothing. And he sends the message out. Other T cells come around immediately. They check in other tears and say, you're right. And they immediately proceed to work and attack the cancer cell that has been hidden in its fibrin coat all along. Dr. Dvorkin checked 57 of the major types of human cancers and discovered that all 57 of them were covered with fibrin, which T cells recognized as being okay since it came from the body in which the fibrin was produced. In looking around over the years, the original enzymes packaged in a product for putting tears in this coat no longer were being produced, and the speaker spent some time in finally finding an enzyme source that would do this. It is important that an individual be taking 3 of these at each meal. Speaking of dietary factors, it's rather interesting that certain ones of them can increase carcinoma incidence, and among these are excess fat, a fiber deficiency, low beta carotene, increased salt or sodium chloride, which of course is an anti-enzyme factor, and so on. It was Starveld years ago that stated that cancer incidence increases in civilized area. And it's the civilized areas that have the above dietary excesses, such as the excess fat and fiber deficiency, low beta carotene, increased salt, and so on. Rather interesting to note that when you take a baked potato with the skin, you get 435 milligrams of potassium in the skin of an average-sized baked potato. However, if you were to take that potato and put, and that is 435 milligrams of potassium to one part of sodium. However, if you were to eat it in potato chips, you're going to get a complete reversal, probably 400 parts sodium to one part potassium. Same thing with French fries, so that you can see that there has been a tremendous reversal, and this reversal occurs in many foods. For example, you can take tomato off the vine, and you will have approximately 45 times the amount of potassium to the amount of sodium in that tomato. Take that tomato in the form of tomato juice or the tomato sauce that's in a pizza, for example, and it'll be totally reversed. As a matter of fact, it can be reversed up to the level of 200 times more sodium than one part potassium. So we have the same thing applies to apples and applesauce. If you eat a raw apple, there's roughly 43 or so parts potassium to one part sodium. But if you eat the apple pan fluffy in a food store or one of these fast food outlets, you will discover that it is totally reversed, far more sodium than there is the amount of potassium. And remembering again that sodium is an enzyme inhibitor, and cancer cells cannot take enzymes, and whereas potassium is an enzyme activator, the very thing you do want to take for treating cancer. We can go now to a rather interesting breast cancer statistics. This was taken from the World Health Organization data on the base cancer mortality. And these were studies done in 33 countries of the world, all compiled on this, and I have the graph of their data in front of me. And here it has breast cancer versus animal food. And we'll notice that if you were to draw a card or take a card roughly 3 by 5 and you were to draw a graph at about a 45 degree angle from the left-hand corner to the right-hand corner, that would be the graph that they're indicating here. And they notice here that there was a significant correlation between breast cancer mortality and milk consumption on this particular graph. This would support the hypothesis that estrogens and insulin-like growth factor, the IGF-1, in cow's milk stimulates breast cancer. When it comes to breast cancer, there's a real significant link with the wearing of bras. Now, if you approach the problem of breast cancer from the perspective of an applied medical anthropologist, then what you would notice that according to the World Health Organization, 70 to 80% of deaths in North America are due to lifestyle. And when it comes to this lifestyle, when they check out the relationship of cancer to the wearing of bras, they come up with rather an interesting finding. Here was a gentleman by the name of Singer that conducted a 2-year bra and breast cancer study in the United States, in which he interviewed nearly 5,000 women about their attitude and behaviors regarding breast and bras. What he discovered was that women with breast cancer had a history of tighter and longer bra wearing than the women who had not yet developed the disease. As a matter of fact, where there are no bras, there's very little breast disease. In fact, virtually all of the cancer group wore bras over 12 hours a day, with 18% even sleeping with their bras, which means they wore bras 24 hours a day, this 18%, that is. In contrast, a comparison group had 25% of the women either bra-free or wearing bras less than 12 hours a day. Only 3% of this group slept with their bras on. And this groundbreaking study revealed a link between bras and breast cancer that's 3 times greater than the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Get this now. There was a 125 times increase in breast cancer incidence between women who were bra-free and those who wore bras 24 hours a day. Wearing a bra over 12 hours daily confirmed a real drop to only 113 times the increase in breast cancer incidence compared with bra-free women. Now, that's not much of a drop, because when you compare the non-bra woman with one that's wearing a bra just barely over 12 hours a day, still having 113 times the incidence of cancer here, then we would wonder, why should this occur? Well, it's not too hard to figure out if you do some basic physiological thinking. About 3 or 4 years ago, they had an international conference on breast cancer in Toronto. And one of the things that came up in the studies was that in examining breasts that had been removed because they had cancer, and normal breast tissue associated with the lumps that had been removed in lumps, they discovered the following. This breast cancer tissue was high in pesticides, and no one had made the connection. But the next year, when someone came to, or 2 years later, when came to the conference and wanted to give a paper on the relationship with pesticides and breast cancer, the paper was not accepted. Now, what is happening here is this, that in the breasts, the majority of lymph drainage goes to the armpit lymph nodes. We all know this, because when women get cancer of the breast, it's most frequently in what we call the axillary tail of Spence, which is a tail of the breast that moves to the armpit. Now, in those most delightful pieces of equipment, we have to note that the lymph drainage is coming from a tissue which is primarily, or has a very high proportion of fat. Fat absorbs fat-soluble herbicides, insecticides, other pesticides. When you're wearing a tight bra, you are preventing the normal drainage of these toxins. And this was why they were able to take tissue and find a high level of these pesticides in breast tissue. Well, just think a minute. If you stop the flow in a sewage pipe that's loaded with toxins, in the dark, and it's a temperature of 97 degrees Fahrenheit, or body temperature, what do you expect to happen in those pipes? You would expect that there would be a high level of pollution in such tissues, and this, in fact, is the case. And since this kind of pollution is extremely toxic in being also carcinogenic, it shouldn't surprise you that the wearing of bras is a problem related to a higher incidence, a much higher incidence of cancer. So having said this now, all the people listening to this tape can now note how this speaker is wanting to see them the next time he does. This rather reminds me of the lighter side of modern medicine, where I'm looking at a cartoon where the big banner says AMA press conference and various TV stations in the audience and so on with their signs. And there's a speaker saying, "Who says we cannot compete with alternative medicine in prevention? Just the other day, I did a double mastectomy for fibrocystic breast disease, and I could guarantee her 100% that she'd never get breast cancer." In a sense, that's like the doctor that reported to the wife that after they had treated her husband, he was 100% clear of cancer, but he unfortunately died, and he was cured. One factor that we haven't noted very much of recently or in these tapes has been the fact that stress is a real problem. And we talk about that in another tape, but I want to note that stress, particularly in the elite athlete, also depresses immunity. But recovery occurs here in approximately 24 hours. Elite exercises such as the Olympic trainer and so on are known to have colds and flus, like symptoms, within hours of their competition. But ordinary exercise will lead to an increase of endorphins, which lead to an increase of interleukin-1, also an increase in interferon, and increase in T cells. Where interferon and T cells are elevated, so too is our immunity. I might note here that one of the easiest ways of increasing interferon rather than getting it with shots is by taking a little higher levels of vitamin C. And you should always take those after you've eaten just so you don't get gastritis as a result. Now, it was Pauling and Stewart, later confirmed by two people, Murashige and Murata in Japan, who noted that if you took 5,000 milligrams or less of vitamin C per day, that it was the same as taking none in terms of helping you as far as your cancer was concerned. But you had to take more than 5,000 a day to get the benefits of a higher vitamin C as it applies to the increasing survival in cancer. As we said before, Pauling and Stewart of the Vale of Leven Hospital in Scotland treated patients with various levels of vitamin C. When they got over the 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, and their involvement dealt with untreatable cancer cases, in other words, terminal ones, it's interesting to note that those who were on the high levels of vitamin C were surviving much better. For example, in approximately 100 days after their admission to the hospital, and they were just put, as they came into the door, put in groups A, B, C, or D, they noted that when 88% of the terminal cancer cases had died in approximately 100 days, 53% of the ones on the high vitamin C, and that was a narrow spectrum product, were still alive. In other words, they had a survival rate of 12% in those who were not on the high levels of vitamin C, and of 53% of those who were on the high levels of vitamin C. And in spite of that, we get people that tell us that vitamin C is a worry, that it might change some DNA problems, whereas we know that the chemotherapy we've talked about before absolutely does cause DNA changes in cancer cases. Here, in Pauling and Stewart's case, they had 2 years later, 7% of all of those people that had been brought in terminal were still alive. And the other thing that's rather interesting is that when all of them had died in about just a bit over 1 year, they still had 16% of the others that were still alive. Now, the Mayo Clinic, shortly thereafter, they did a study in which they gave less than 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day to their cancer cases, which they had subjected first to the maximum amount of chemo and or maximum amount of radiation or maximum amount of combinations, which had not been done in the Leven Hospital at Scotland. It was rather interesting that they then put a heading saying that Pauling and Stewart's work not confirmed. If you recall, we already said that they had discovered that taking less than 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day was the same as taking none. And so they put their patients that they studied in the Mayo Clinic on what amounted to none, and then said the vitamin C study couldn't be confirmed. When, however, some people in Japan picked up on Pauling and Stewart's work and did a correct duplication of the study, they got virtually the same results that they got in Scotland. This study was done, as we said before, by Morishige and Murata, and when they had only 7% still alive in approximately 100 days, there was 51% of the others on the high vitamin C still alive. And they averaged 29 grams of vitamin C a day. As with the other studies, in more than a year's time, I am going to note here also that when 100% of the low ascorbate patients were dead, there were still 25% of the high vitamin C patients alive. Well, this writer uses vitamin C in high levels for his cancer cases and a lot of other things as well. I do not believe in the magic bullet, since we're dealing with a very complex system. It is interesting to note here that this writer has frequently been told, oh, you can't take that much vitamin C, that's a terrible overdose and it will cause kidney stones. Well, number one, it does not cause kidney stones. What causes kidney stones, well researched in Sweden, one of the first countries, is a low active vitamin B6 and a low magnesium intake. Taking both of those will put a stop to the formation of kidney stones, number one. Number two, isn't it interesting that the cat we have that's sleeping on my favorite chair and leaving his hair all over makes approximately 3,500 milligrams of vitamin C in its body per day, and he only weighs about 9 pounds. Our dog that we had here actually makes around 9 to 9,500 a day, and he weighs about 70 pounds. And our sheep that weighed about 120 pounds were making 13,000 milligrams of vitamin C in their bodies per day. The human being with the guinea pig, some apes and some fish, some flying grasshoppers, and the red-vented bulbul bird are one of the few that do not make vitamin C in their bodies and are dependent on what they take in their diets. It's rather interesting to note that the Aboriginals in Australia right now take approximately 9 or 10 thousand milligrams a day in their diets, and the Indians living in North America did the same, with being a little less, somewhere around the 9,000 levels per day in their diets before the white man was here. We had mentioned stress, and with that I always make a comment that it's well known that cancer appears in people who have undergone severe stress, and all doctors have noticed when a husband has lost a wife, or a wife has lost a husband, or the family has lost their only child through accident or a divorce or whatever, that they have a much higher incidence of cancer as a result of the stress that they suffer. Now, there have been some state that stress of a divorce or separation is greater than the loss of a loved one from an accident. So to that I say to women that are in the midst of a divorce or separation, don't divorce them, shoot them. Since cancer arises from normal cells getting sick, and remember that was the Nobel Prize winners Pons and Varmus that discovered that and got a Nobel Prize for proving it, the cancer assumes the character of the tissue from which it comes. That is, if the source tissue grows slowly, the cancer will also, and vice versa. Which means that if you get a cancer of, say, intestinal cells, linings that grow rather quickly, that cancer will be growing rather quickly also. When treating cancer, we should not just go at the lump, as it were, but we should really decrease the carcinogens, such as in trans fats. And trans fat is different than the way the good Lord has made them, which is a cis fat, C-I-S. Cis fat has a bent body, and it has arms sticking out of various sides of it, and with the carbons and hydrogens, oxygens, and so on stuck on them. And when they are heated, not the arms, but the fats, then the arms will flip over to the opposite side, and we call it a trans fat, such as in Trans Canada, meaning across Canada. In this case, the arms flip over. You get what may look like a mirror image, but unfortunately, we do not have receptor sites in our bodies for these mirror image trans fats. They therefore can accumulate in us and give us trouble. Okay? Now, the receptor sites look much like, or you could think of them as a plug in the wall that's supposed to receive a certain type of plug so that it can get the energy from that wall. If you twist those plugs and put the round one where one of the flat ones should be, or you turn the flat ones horizontal instead of vertical, or one of them horizontal instead of vertical, and so on, you need a different kind of plug because you've got a different receptor site. With trans fats, we have the wrong plug for the receptor sites. And it's interesting to note that with trans fats, the aging of the face is greatly increased, so that women and men who do not want to get wrinkles prematurely should avoid two things, or a number of things. One of them is trans fats. The other is sucking fire nipples. That's the terminology for smoking. And the other is extra exposure to sunlight. Well, so much for we should decrease the carcinogens. But we should decrease their intensity as well, which means that if a person is sucking 10 fire nipples a day, he would do better if he brought it down to 5. However, I'm not usually impressed by that, since I've had people tell me, hey, look, I cut down from 20 cigarettes a day down to 5 now. And so I look at them, and this is what I usually say. I used to say, well, you know, that really doesn't impress me. And they said, well, why not? Well, I said, before you were telling me, I said, I just get a vision of you burning your 10 fingers and your 10 toes in 20 candles, and now you're telling me you're only burning 5 fingers in 5 candles now, and I still scratch my head and say, you still got a problem, okay? We should also increase host resistance. That's increase the body pH. Because as our body pH, and notice I'm saying body and not blood pH, the body does everything it can to maintain a pH of roughly 7.36. But the body pH, which can be indicated by a salivary pH, if it's taken correctly in the right time of the day, which is 10 o'clock in the morning, the body pH will indicate to us how much body acid there is there. The interesting thing with body acid is that the more of it present, the less you can absorb oxygen into your tissues. And I might note here that one of the things that cancer does not like is an abundance of oxygen. It loves to live in an anaerobic or low oxygen environment. The fourth thing that we note that we should attack the cancer safely. And speaking of treating the cancer safely, I'll give you another example. This was given by Hirschhoff in one of his talks, that when Hodgkin's disease is treated with chemo, a higher death rate of 14 times occurs from chemo-induced leukemia later on in the unfortunate person's history. Also, we have found from Hirschhoff that colon cancer plus chemo leads to a 35% survival in 5 years. But colon cancer with no chemo gave a 68% survival in 5 years. If you want to survive, it would sound like if you had colon cancer, you'd be getting close to doubling your chances, or for a longer survival definitely, without the presence of chemo. The New England Journal of Medicine reported from Buffalo, New York, that in a 70-week study of 572 patients, that's 1 year and 4 months, in those 572 patients, also in 13 hospitals, the patients did not live any longer by receiving chemotherapy. Other findings quoted in that same New England Journal of Medical report was, number one, those having chemo after surgery did not live any longer. Number two, 5.5 years following surgery, drug treatment made no difference in survival. Number three, 33% having surgery only had the cancer return. 35% having surgery plus chemo had the cancer return. And 37% with surgery plus interferon had cancer return. But I must note here too that interferon was not the interferon spontaneously induced by high vitamin C. Number six, 29% having surgery, interferon, and chemo had the carcinoma return. And number seven, of the chemo cases in number six above, seven came down with leukemia. Well, let's have a look at some good news. In The Lancet by Garland et al., the blood levels of vitamin D were noted in colon cancer patients and others, showing that the more vitamin D present, the less was the risk of colon cancer developing. Their estimate was that 80% of cases are probably prevented by an adequate vitamin D. There'll be more good news later. For those of you who still can't get over this bit about radiation and its harmful effects that we noted earlier, I'm going to get you to do a little something. Supposing now you make a graph. On the y or vertical axis, you put probability. On the x-axis or the horizontal axis, you put x-ray dose. And on the left-hand side of the left axis, right down near the zero, you put low. And on the right-hand side, you put high, which simply indicates a rough graph going from low x-ray dose to high x-ray dose. If then you start at the bottom left-hand corner and you draw a curve sort of swooping up as you get to the top right-hand corner of your graph so that it looks like a curve to a ball. So you have that one curve there. Then if you start at the top of the left-hand corner and you make another ball curve swoop down, this time with the curve up, whereas the first one was with the curve down. Now you will notice that they will cross somewhere roughly in the middle of your graph. These two curves will. Now, the first curve we drew that swoops up in its circle and getting higher and higher as you get to the right, this represents cancer cells killed from radiation. The other one that starts at the top left-hand corner and sweeps down toward the word high on the right-hand bottom side of the x-axis or horizontal axis is normal cells okay. Now, what's it saying here? If you look at the left-hand side of your graph, you will have two portions of a curve. One portion of each curve. You will have normal cells okay, that's high. You come straight down and you'll find that the x-ray dose is low. Now, it should be obvious, therefore, that as your x-ray dose increases, the number of cancer cells being killed will rise. That's your bottom curve, your first curve going up. Also, the more the x-ray dose is, the probability of normal cells being okay as a result of that x-ray dose is going to drop. So that when we have a very high x-ray dose, we've killed all the cancer cells, but we've also killed all the normal cells. So you have a patient cured of cancer lying as a corpse, and you have to phone Foster and McGarvey or one of those other funeral homes. So what I'm saying is that if you say anywhere along, let's say you took where the curves crossed and you said that was a safe dose, that means that you've only killed a portion of the cancer cells. What cells have you left behind? You have left the toughest, strongest, most radioactive resistant cells alive. And what have you done? You've killed off a high level of normal cells as well. In doing that, not only have you left the strongest cancer cells alive, you've compromised the number of healthy cells left to fight with these strong cancer cells. Now that's just common horse sense, and if you can visualize that one, you can get a picture of where this writer goes, or speaker goes, in terms of the treating cancer. We also want to indicate again and again, as I know it's repetitive, but it's important to decrease the carcinogen and its intensity. I'll give you another study where Kansas study of farmers, white males, some using 2,4-D and some not, and the incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. If you take the group that didn't use the 2,4-D at all, there was no increase of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma over the general population. But if the farmers were using 2,4-D more than 20 days per year, there was a six-fold increase of this malignant disease. And if they used and mixed 2,4-D, there was an eightfold increase of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, simply telling us, therefore, the importance of decreasing both the carcinogen and its intensity. Now, the other thing we have mentioned, and this is where the good part comes, namely increasing host resistance. Now, in an Australian study done by Kuhn and his group, published in Nutrition and Cancer, 1,442 subjects, 20-year diet record regarding cancer of the colon, one of the common cancers we have today. What were the findings of these records over this 20-year period? Well, here they were. A, fiber and veggies protected against the colon cancer. B, so too did cruciferous vegetables such as cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, broccoli. C, pulse, such as beans, peas, lentils, nuts, and seed fiber, gave no protection. The incidence was just the same. But having said that, I must note one bean, namely fermented soya bean, which is included in pulse, is known to decrease the risk of many cancers, and it lowers cholesterol, incidentally, 20% to 30%, if and when animal protein intake is low, and in other words, if your meat intake is lower than what it is presently, no doubt. D, high fat increased the risk, particularly if the fiber intake was low. Fruit, there was no alteration in the risk, but this does not hold for dry fruit, which increases the risk due to increased sugar intake. And this is why in cancer cases we insist that there's four times as many vegetables eaten as raw fruit, that no one ever eats raisins or grapes because they have glucose in them and glucose paralyzes your white cells for up to 4 or 5 hours. And that all fruit juices, for the same reason of decreasing the sugar, which paralyzes your white blood cells, and that's the last thing you want to have paralyzed when you have this terrible disease, that you dilute that fruit juice 50-50 with water. The next one was poultry, and no increase of risk provided the skin wasn't eaten. The next one was beef, which increased the risk of getting colon cancer. Now, it's interesting here because a few of us doctors over the years noted that whenever our cancer cases had surgery and were given transfusions, they didn't last as long as those that had surgery for the same type of disease and were not given transfusions. Now, since beef is red, it indicates that it's got a lot of red blood cells in it, and that's blood, and so it's the same as beef, that there is a risk for eating beef as well as having high transfusions, which is high iron. The next factor that they noted was that fish was protective, and you'd remember the haddock we mentioned because it's high in iodine, and the lower the iodine was in your tissues, the more easily it was for cancer cells to replicate.